Hello, and thank you for joining us today for this thought leader conversation. The topic for today is the quest for readiness. We are happy to have John Gompertz, President and CEO of the America's Promise Alliance, Karen Pittman, CEO and co-founder of the Forum for Youth Investment, and Sean Slade, Director of Whole Child Programs at ASCD. The Forum for Youth Investment will offer these sessions periodically to bring national leaders together to discuss important issues. For today's session, there will be an audio feed only. We are not using PowerPoint today. After the session, we will write up a brief blog post that will be featured on readyby21.org, and we will be recording the session for later listening. To share your thoughts or ask questions during the presentation, please go to Twitter and use the hashtag ReadyYouth to join the conversation. Thank you again, and it is my pleasure to turn the session over to Karen Pittman.
Thank you, and welcome those of you who have joined us. I'm sure we'll have more folks joining us in a few minutes. We had over 500 people register for the call, so we're expecting good numbers. A diverse group, lots of people from United Ways, from school districts, funders. I think we ended up with, looking at my list, about 20 cities that have at least four people on them from those communities, and we have registered folks from about 15 states. So a good diverse group, and we encourage you to, as you listen, send in your questions to hashtag ReadyYouth. I'm delighted to be here with two friends, who I've had the occasion of being at their conferences over the past couple months, Grad Nation and the Whole Child Symposium, and so invited them to come sit around my table. We're literally sitting around the table in my office to continue conversations that we started about this idea of readiness and what it takes to get young people ready for college, work, and life. I want to kick it off and then turn it immediately to Sean and John, but I want to read two quotes that I carry around with me. One is a quote from the National Governors Association. It's about a decade old now, but it reads this: "The continued ability of states to compete in the global economy hinges on how well they enable their younger citizens to attain the competencies and social attributes necessary to fuel economic growth and contribute to the well-being of families and communities." So underlying competencies and social attributes. And then, from Mission Readiness, which is a nonpartisan national security organization of retired admirals and generals that are calling for smart investments in America's children and youth, their website leads off with this headline: "Currently, 75% of 17 to 24-year-olds in the U.S. cannot serve in the military because they are too poorly educated, too overweight, or have a serious criminal record. Investing early in the upcoming generation is critical to securing our nation's future." So two statements from groups that we don't necessarily think have huge personal investments in education, but clearly need an educated workforce. And what I find interesting with both is their definitions of what makes young people ready: competencies, attributes, and then on the military side, it's a combination of them not being ready at a staggering number of 3 out of 4 because they're either poorly educated, they're not healthy, the sign of obesity, or they have taken a wrong course to the point that they have a criminal record, making them ineligible. So with those two sort of end goals of young people who are fueling our economy as a workforce, our young people who are contributing in the military, and these broad definitions of readiness, let's just talk a little bit about what the difference is. I'm going to put out three words. What's the difference between having a credential, whether it's a high school diploma, an associate's degree, a college, 4-year college degree, having a set of competencies and being ready for the things that we expect young people to be ready for, whether that's work, it's the military, it's life. How do you all use those words? Are they interchangeable for you? Let's sort of start with, where do credentials fit into readiness? Equivalent, the same, John?
I don't think the same at all. First of all, thank you, Karen, for doing this. It seems like an inspired idea. I'm certainly tickled to be here talking with you and Sean today. I think this will be fun. I hope we do hear a lot of questions from people who are on the line. So as you know, we're running this Grad Nation campaign, and we picked high school graduation. This is going to be sort of an answer in the negative. We picked high school graduation as the goal, not because we think high school graduation is the end-all, be-all. We would be silly to think that high school graduation, you know, if you get there, it's all good, right? But it is, we selected it because it's a really good, easy to understand, externally measured barometer of readiness. And I will readily concede, it's not a perfect measure of readiness in the positive. You can, in fact, graduate from high school, and many young people do graduate from high school and aren't actually ready going to these other qualities that you talked about, Karen. But in today's world, today's economy, today's workplace, to not graduate from high school means almost certainly you are not ready. Your well-being is not outstanding, and you are not ready to continue to move towards adult success. So that's why we call high school graduation really the second starting line. It's no longer, I assume before we were all thinking about all this, there was a time when you could essentially stumble across the stage, pick up your diploma, and it was going to be good enough at least. Those days are gone. It's now you cross that stage to reach the second starting line. And then I think we can go from there. I'd love to hear what Sean says, but we can go from there about what actually makes you ready to progress towards adult success.
Yeah. No, I think using that barometer of graduation makes perfect sense because, as you were saying, it's externally evaluated and moderated, and we can use that as a dividing line. You know, there are so many, you can definitely say that people who do not graduate are more likely to be not ready for future life and career and citizenship, whereas those who have graduated are ready. What I do is, though, when I first saw or heard your question, but also thought about what we were discussing today, the first question that came to my mind was really, ready for what? You know, so not to be pedantic in answering a question with a question, but hopefully broadening the discussion, because I think that we sometimes forget what the ultimate aim is, and if we don't have a common vision of what we're trying to get to and what we're trying to do, then we start to put in place some of these steps and some of these metrics that might be measuring something that we don't intentionally want as an outcome. So my question would go back and say, all right, what are we getting people ready for? Because the credential is showing that yes, you are ready for a job or a position in a certain industry. However, it's not showing that you're necessarily ready as a citizen or ready for to take on the world. It doesn't show that you're necessarily a problem solver or a collaborator. So my question goes back to what is the ready that we're looking for what purpose? And we sometimes, in some of our discussions, pose it back to the audience and say, describe to me what you think the child at 25. Think of a child, your child, or when you were a child. What do you want to see? What qualities, what attributes do you want in that child? And we say 25 because, as John was saying, we may not want to take just graduation. If we can extend that, that's not the be-all and end-all. There is more after that. People will say things almost man for man, woman for woman, no matter where we do this. They'll say somebody who is self-reliant, somebody who is confident, someone who is happy and healthy, who is a citizen, who has a career path, who is resilient, who is a collaborator. And these words come out. Nobody says, and I'm being facetious here, nobody says adequate at language arts or proficient in year 9 math or some of the things that we measure. Those are steps along the way. but they're only steps along the way if we actually know what we're trying to aim for. So I think as we answer the question, we also need to ask, you know, a bigger or a broader question.
I love that response, Sean. I think we all celebrate the engagement of the business community in this conversation about young people, as reflected in what the NGA said and you know, what the generals and admirals say. But sometimes I worry that it makes the whole conversation very transactional, that it's actually only about being ready for work. I think many of the most the smartest and most enlightened employers are realizing that actually to succeed in the workplace, you need a whole set of qualities that go beyond, include, but go beyond. But I also think this ready for what question has two interesting dimensions. One is, world's changing very fast, and we may not be able to answer that question. So if we can't say specifically what for, then what qualities is it that we would like human beings to have in order to be adaptable, learn new things, and so forth. The other is, I think it expands the conversation in terms of time. As I said, our focus has been high school graduation, but only insofar as it's a measure of well-being and readiness to move forward towards adult success. But we are having, we've had challenges with high school graduation. We have remaining challenges. We obviously have challenges with college access and then college attainment. But we're also seeing challenges in integrating into the workforce. I actually like the age 25 thing because I think our challenges go much broader. Even if we just stay with workplace stuff, it goes broader than just education. But this readiness to enter the workforce, understand what that's about, and be able to behave properly, adapt as necessary. And I think that we, as a society and even as organizations, haven't grappled with this whole pathway to opportunity and really getting a solid first or second step in adult life.
And I like what you said as well. You may not have caught yourself saying it, but you were one thing you said when you talked about we don't know what the future is going to bring, and so we have to make sure our children are adaptable to that. Because we know that it's going to be changing, and it's one thing we know for sure, it'll be different from what it is now. So if we know that we want them to be, in one aspect, adaptable, then we have to teach and develop the ability to be adaptable, you know, and to change, and to actually make your own decisions and, you know, forge your own course. So
let's dig into this further, because that was a great opening, Salvo, that got all these ideas out there exactly as I knew you all would, even though we hadn't scripted this at all. So there are a couple of things that I want to just come back to focus on. One is that, John, I think you said it very accurately, and I've heard you say it before, you know, the high school diploma doesn't necessarily act as a perfect measure that you are ready or have all of those competencies or skills that you need, but it certainly acts as a good proxy for not being ready. But I think there's something perverse that we have there, which we're going to come back to in a minute, in some ways, if we want to be crass, even duping some young people into believing that they are ready because they managed to get that diploma, and then they show up at the doorstep of college or they show up at the doorstep of an employer. And what employers tell us across all industries is that 4 out of 10 young people who show up for entry-level jobs with a high school diploma, they send away because they don't have what you said, Sean.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have problem-solving skills, communication skills. They may be able to read and write and nab, but they can't communicate. They don't have problem-solving skills. They don't have teamwork skills. They don't have self-regulation skills. They end up not being employable.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not even about the content of the job. Employers are willing to train to the specific skills, but they're looking for young people to be ready for work who are coming with that sort of package that we used to call work ethic or whatever you want to call it. And they're quite specific about that. So I want us to sort of explore more the rest of the ideas that you put out about especially the sort of that list of attributes that people universally generate when you say, what do you want, young people?
Yeah.
And when you ask young people, what qualities, what attributes, what skills should you have? for you to be confident that you can step into a situation and succeed in it, whether that's life, whether that's a community organization that you're volunteering in, it's work, it's college, et cetera. The second thing that you said, so that credential starts to be a liability when we're not up front with young people and their families, that credential may not in and of itself get them ready unless we're doing a pretty massive job of changing practice inside the school to point more towards these attributes.
Well, the problem, I think, with education in general, and this is not a criticism of educators,
mm-hmm.
it's more of a criticism of policymakers, is that education tends to be reactive to society as opposed to being proactive. So I think it was Daniel Pink or someone that said that we're about a generation or two behind
right.
in the way that we educate our children and what we start to develop. So we are still in, and forget about the physical buildings, it's more about how we are educating and what we are educating. We are still educating in a 20th century mindset, even though we've had, and it's now 2014, we've had at least 14 years of people saying those are not necessarily the skills that we need to develop. We need to develop, and it's come out from everybody. It's come out from the OECD. It's come out from the Chamber of Commerce. It's come out from, as you were saying before, entities that we might typically not think would be shouting from the hilltop the need to, you know, for us to develop collaboration and empathy and resilience and perseverance and problem solving. So I think in a way we need to get over education as a broad context needs to start being more proactive and get away from being just reactive. How we might do that is a bigger question. But we do tend to be the institution that drags its feet into what needs to be done. And again, it's more directed towards policymakers as opposed to educators.
So is this just a question of what gets measured, gets done, coupled with just the fact that we've got, 100 years of doing it one way? If we really need to flip from leading with content that you're supposed to master to leading with this list of competencies that everybody universally agrees young people need to have, is it just that we don't know how to measure them? That we keep falling back on saying that you passed your algebra exam versus that you have built sufficient resilience skills?
Well, a couple of thoughts on this. I just wanted to expand out that it's not just employers who are telling us this. It's colleges and universities that are saying young people aren't ready. And that's why I really do believe that college and career ready standards, that stuff is super important. And I don't think any of us want to downplay how important that is. I also think that the qualities that we're talking about are often qualities that are not learned necessarily through classroom instruction. They may be learned in part in school because of the socializing effects of school, but they're also learned in other activities, and they're learned in life from the people with whom you are surrounded. Right? And so what we know is that a lot of young people are growing up in particularly challenging circumstances where they don't have all of that surround sound that helps people observe what behaviors are the behaviors that are going to work in the workplace and in the rest of life, develop them, get corrected as all of us were corrected in one way or another. So I definitely think that we want to see how schools can contribute to the development of these qualities. And I worry that if we try to heap things on schools that schools wouldn't be good delivery systems for, or at least, let's say, traditional public schools wouldn't be good delivery systems for, because I suspect from my friends who send their kids to private school, this is actually a lot of what goes on in independent schools is the development of all of these qualities in many dimensions, as well as reading Shakespeare.
But I differ slightly in what you were saying, John, only to say that these are skills that don't always get taught in school or developed in school, and they should be developed in the community. But they're also skills that can be taught in school and developed in school.
Exactly.
So for those students who maybe aren't getting that extra attention or that extra interaction outside of school, it really does fall back, or maybe it should fall back onto the school to look at how they're developing some of these. And there is a colleague of ours, for example, which I think is a nice little example. He Tom Hoare, and he runs the New City School in St. Louis. And it's a school that's based around multiple intelligences, and which in itself is somewhat unique and interesting. But what they then start to do to develop things like resilience and perseverance is they may teach you, if you are more mathematical or logistical, directed towards that intelligence, but they will also purposefully try to teach you up on the intelligences that you are not automatically strong with. One, to increase the skills in that, but also to get you familiar with how to deal with things that are not that easy and not that simple. So I think the schools, maybe they don't all do that right now, but I also think that they can do it.
Mm-hmm.
I agree with we can't just keep on adding more and more things. So as we start to maybe change the focus of what schools should be doing, we also have to discard some of the things that they maybe don't need to do as much anymore.
So let's put a couple things out there. Again, this is great, and you landed right in the middle of what I think is going to need to be the discussion that we have in much more sophisticated and sustained ways over the next couple of years. The most important thing you said, John, when you started was to say these qualities may not be learned in the classroom. They're learned in other places. The word that you used was learned. The most important thing that we have to put on the table is these are skills and attributes that are learned. It may be a little bit of a nature nurture. You're born more creative, et cetera. But these are things that are learned, and these are skills that have to be practiced and named.
Yeah.
So if society values these, which we keep saying, employers, college, everybody says we have to have them, what do we need to do to name them in more systems and settings to provide ample time for young people to practice them and get feedback on them? And then, at some point, if we think we need a credential, to make sure that the credentials we're handing out are only handed out when young people actually demonstrate these skills in sufficient quantity. It is, the nice thing about them is if we do it right, and there's really a lot of wonderful research that's been done on how you build these skills, they're not built in a vacuum. They're built when you are practicing on something. So the reason we don't build these in classrooms is that classrooms are abstract. Until the classroom is using project-based learning or until we're doing something that has young people actually working together in which they've got an environment in which they have to collaborate, they have to have teamwork, they have to be tested in a situation in which they're uncomfortable and see how they react. And somebody's watching to give them feedback. If we're not creating those kind of environments, if it's really just sit in your chair and take notes and take a test to see if you've mastered content, then it does feel like adding on.
Yeah.
But if we're really understanding that in order to build these skills, you have to be building learning environments, whether they're in school, they're in youth organizations, they're in faith organizations, they're in your business apprenticeship programs, they're in families. This is why families have chores for kids.
Mm-hmm.
You're in a situation in which you are doing something, and in the course of doing something that has meaning and purpose, you are practicing these skills and somebody's helping you name them and assess how well you're doing on them. That is a combined learning experience. We've got solid evidence that when we create those kind of learning environments, regardless of the content that's being taught, when I create a learning environment in which we're actually giving you a chance to practice these skills and apply them to something meaningful, young people are engaged. When young people are engaged, they practice more and they demonstrate these skills. And then the trick is, once they've got these skills, they transfer them into the other places.
Yes.
So when we go to John's point of maybe schools aren't the best place where these skills are learned, if educators are recognizing clearly that whatever you want me to learn, and workforce folks as well, and folks in prevention and folks in remediation, this is not just a school versus work conversation. You go into juvenile justice, child welfare, independent living, what are the skills that we're trying to get young people to build to either get out of systems and not get back in them? Same list of skills.
Yeah.
So we've got a lot of folks investing a lot of money in creating environments that somehow don't manage to put these skills front and center, but expect young people to get them by osmosis.
Yeah.
And so the question is, how do we start a conversation in which we put these skills and competencies first and say, this is what we all need to be coming together to make sure young people know they're building, understand it. Young people, parents, everybody says, this is what's important, whether there's a credential that's associated with these or not. And, you know, that some of this is in competency-based education, but that also gets taken off into sidelines. So that's the conversation, I think, Sean, that we have to have. And then the question is, if schools aren't the ideal place where these skills are learned, two things are happening. One, if these skills aren't being learned, young people are spending a lot of time in school and not practicing. Two, they're not mastering the content because they're not engaged, because they're not building these skills.
Yeah.
And then three, if we're going to keep talking about school reform, either these skills, either we have to have a teaching force, and more importantly, just a whole building force that's reinforcing these skills and is changing practice, or we have to really have a much clearer acknowledgement that those other places, youth organizations, faith organizations, business internships, family, where these skills could be being built more naturally because your bureaucracy isn't against those skill building, that those places need airtime.
Yeah.
You know, the Ford Foundation talks about more and better learning time, and they have a more and better learning time initiative. What you identified, John, was that it's not just more and better. We need more better learning time. And if we actually started to, if we had some way of measuring the proportion of time low-income young people spend, not just in learning, which is also, we also know that that in and of itself is less, but in better learning, it would really, really be less. If this is at the core of better learning, then one of the reasons that we're not making the progress that we can make is that the amount of time young people are spending in quality learning environments, in school, out of school, wherever, in which people are paying attention to these things as well as paying attention to high-quality content is really pretty slim.
Yeah, and I think there's, in a way, this also reminds me of the conversation we're actually having, in a way, before we got onto this phone call, which is we've seen over the last decade at least that things become somewhat siloed, whether we're talking about a sector or whether we're talking about a content area that needs to be learned, that you teach this thing in a silo on its own, disconnected from something else. Whereas the most effective classrooms and the most effective teachers and lessons, they are teaching content, they're teaching differentiation, but they're also teaching these different skills that go along with it, and they are aware that they are doing that. And I think the more that we understand that, and I say this occasionally in many of my talks, that our children don't grow up in siloed environments where they're only dealing with this issue or that issue or this action. They live in whole worlds, and we need to start appreciating that. So I think the articulation of what these skills are and the realization by not only teachers but also community that these skills need to be taught, and they're taught in this environment, is what's key. I think because the good schools and the good teachers and the good lessons, they're already doing it and they're already aware of it. And then the ones that aren't aware of it, the kids who are picking it up, as you were saying, by osmosis, are the ones that are benefiting the most. They're the ones who are being more proactive in group discussions or collaboration. But it shouldn't be up to the child to force that learning to occur. It should be up to the school and the teacher to actually make sure that there is this path for teaching collaboration or perseverance or problem solving.
Yeah, wow, this is a great point. It takes me back, Karen, to something you said about measurement. And I think there are a couple of inherent tensions here that we should acknowledge. Like if you're a school right now, you know how you're getting evaluated, right? There's no mystery to that. And we can argue about over-testing and so forth. what's clear is that accountability is here to stay. Mm-hmm. We're not going to spend this much money on this many with this high of stakes and not know what's going on. That's not acceptable. So how do we create accountability around these skills and competencies and attributes? Another tension for me is I'm quite enthusiastic about this movement of evidence-based practice. Naturally, we would want to spend money on things that work more than we want to spend money on things that you can't prove that work, particularly when it's taxpayer money. At the same time, if we think about our own kids, I'm not sure we have any idea what works. Like, is it gymnastics, clarinet, soccer, summer camp, a nice aunt? Who knows? And as parents, I don't know that we sort it out. We do everything and have the child live in an environment where the child interacts with many adults who have different competencies, gets the opportunity to observe and get feedback from many adults, and then kids quit piano. They're not good at it. They don't like the piano teacher. That's okay. That doesn't mean they're not resilient. It just means that. So I think it's that whole experience, sometimes lightly managed, sometimes helicopter managed by very engaged parents, is the growing up process, right? So how do we create something that's like that, that doesn't waste a bunch of taxpayer dollars, because we don't want to do that, but that recognizing that growing up happens in many, many dimensions and needs all kinds of input and all kinds of interactions with various types of adults who are successful in different veins and various kinds of kids who are good at different things, because the kid learns her or his own identity through that process. And that's what I mean by I don't want to heap it all on school, and I know that school has all this accountability pressure and so forth. Of course, I agree. A well-taught activity has all these dimensions. The feedback, if it's more than just a test score, has, you know, Karen, you did really wonderfully on this. I love the way that you responded to Sean when he questioned what you said. And I think in the future you might want to think about this other thing because you left Tim out of that conversation and you could have gotten the value of his input. Mm-hmm. Of course, that would be wonderful. But I also am really alert to the pressure that schools are under right now.
Absolutely.
So how do we balance
things? Absolutely. Yeah. You know, I think that this takes us to another place, which is we can talk about schools, and we should talk about schools, but in this, what do you want to call it, expanded learning, extended learning, in this sort of growing movement that says young people both need more time, the learning space needs to get made bigger, the partners in that learning space need to get broader, and then the quality of what happens in that learning space needs to get better. All those need to happen at the same time. So you've got three ways to get towards your ideal picture.
Yeah.
But the only way we're going to do that is, from an accountability perspective, is to basically take shared accountability for that bigger space.
Yeah.
So if I have basically taken that little cube, that box at school, and I've blown it out all three sides, the time dimension, the competence dimension, so I'm not just teaching you algebra or whatever, and where you can be, you know, who you're with when you're doing that.
Yeah,
so I've blown out all of those. Then the question is, we need a new mechanism for accountability. We need new measures, but we also just need new ways to hold these partners collectively accountable. And one way to do that is to start to say, well, let's see what we can measure in very gross ways. Let's measure time. The ask task, the After School Corporation just came out, I don't know, a couple months ago with their 6,000 hours report, which has a wonderful little video, which basically says, when you calculate it, by sixth grade, middle-class kids have spent 6,000 more hours learning than poor kids.
Yeah.
Wow.
Now, 6,000 hours, even if I count it as, let's count it as an extended day, that's a 10-hour day that I've spent learning, school or after school.
Yeah.
Well, that's 600 and days.
That's
a lot of days.
That's a lot of days. 2 years.
That's 2 years.
It's, Rahm Emanuel said something about, similarly, like, that's 2 years of school.
And we haven't even gotten the quality. We're just talking amount.
Yeah, pure time. And
we're still talking, we're expanding the definition of learning time, but we're still talking about formal learning time, not informal learning time. So the work that Bob Putnam is doing about the difference between middle-class kids and low-income kids in terms of the enrichment that exists in their lives, which, you know, for a lot of middle-class kids with engaged parents is basically from the moment you wake up to the moment you go to sleep, right? And maybe they're playing music while you're sleeping, too. And how that drives this opportunity gap. So, yeah, we absolutely have to expand that, the organized formal and semi-formal things, but we have to think about the whole kid.
And the more we are thinking proactively, back to your word, not reactively, about what those environments are. Well, if we have an environment in which for 7-8 hours a day we're telling people they have to be 5 days a week, 9 months a year, let's certainly make sure that we're getting quality in that space.
Yeah.
And we're going to have to find a way to accelerate the conversation of quality, leading with, you've created quality environments where learning these attributes is named and important. We're going to have to figure that out. Now we go to the next layer. So if there are other quasi-formal places where young people go, after-school programs, recreation programs, et cetera, let's put that on the radar screen. Let's make sure that we understand where those are, whether they're accessible, whether they're quality, whether they're coordinated, whether young people are actually attending enough to get the dosage amount. That says we've got clear evidence there that says young people attend quality after-school programs regularly. Their academic, social, and emotional competencies all go up. Same amount of hours put in to a low-quality program, no change.
Yeah.
So, you know, if we're already investing in sending them, so, I mean, I think the quality word is the word. If we can define quality right and come up with a definition of quality that cuts across systems and settings that really links to these attributes that we can get some agreement on, we're going to walk in and observe whether, and we can do this. Is quality happening here? Is this a quality learning environment? I'm not coming in to see whether you're teaching cutting-edge algebra. I'm coming in to see whether young people are engaged, whether adults are focusing on exactly the situation you just described. I'm coming in to see that that's happening. It gets harder when we want to see that's happening in families or happening informally, but it's not impossible. We might want to do that more from a proactive education perspective than an observation perspective. But if we think we've got families in which this is likely not happening, how are we training parents to be peers and go in and bring this in? How are we having the equivalent of, you know, the home nursing, home visitation program around building these skills and recognizing the kinds of things that you can do? Reginald Clark, probably 10, I think he's still around, 10, 15 years ago, created something called the High Year Learning program that he partnered with Boys and Girls Club. And he literally was helping parents go into other folks' homes and say, sit at their dining table and say, you could be having a conversation rather than have, turn the TV off. Let's have a conversation about what's in the news today.
Well, I think it's both things. And you mentioned it before, and I think John mentioned it as well. It's a broader definition of what learning is. You know, knowing that not only learning does not have to be at a desk with a textbook, with a pen and paper. It's a broader definition. It's also a broader environment of where it's taking place. And I think we need to start as educators of informing the community and society at large that that is what we need to move towards. Because then you start to empower the community in you have a role to play.
Exactly.
You have a purpose in this. It is not just 6 hours a day in this school, in this environment. These things add on to it and actually supplement it, and you can have as much, if not more, of a role to play than what the actual teachers do. And then I like the way also you were talking about the quality, because when you were talking about the 6,000 hours, my mind went to the 10,000 hours from Malcolm Gladwell about that's what it takes to become a master.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and my problem with, I think Malcolm Gladwell is fantastic, but my problem with that theory is that 10,000 hours of bad teaching or bad instruction does not make you a master. 10,000 hours of bad teaching actually can disenfranchise you from wanting to do that, or can actually develop some poor, bad skills that have to be undone later on. So the 10,000 hours goes back to your idea of let's just measure time, and that's one good metric, but it also needs to be under the realm of quality.
Yeah.
You know, you want ideally you want 10,000 hours or however many, but you want quality learning environment and quality instruction. And I do think that the first step that needs to be made is changing the mindset of the people who are, I wouldn't say delivering instruction, but are helping with learning, because we're talking about parents and families and community members here, about what learning is and what it looks like across the whole environment.
Well, let me just throw something at this. We were having conversations in the community, and bringing this kind of conversation into communities is fascinating. So sitting with a group of parents and getting them to say, just as you said, you know, what are the things that you want, you're concerned about your young person, what are the skills and the competencies you want your people to build? Same kind of list comes out. Where do they get to practice those? List comes out. How could we get more of those kind of opportunities happening in your community? Wonderful brainstorm list. You know, we're right on a river. Kids can learn to fish. You can learn so many skills. Wonderful comments coming out. And then there's a, and then we say, well, all right, now we've got these after-school hours. We're in this. These conversations were happening in the context of talking about how do you expand learning, the who, what, where, when, why, how of learning. So we said, well, you have this idea of expand learning, and you've got time. What would you like to see in that? Either if it can't happen in school, we can talk about having it happen in school, but what would you like to see in that 3 to 6 p.m. time? Or 3 to 7 p.m. or summer? And folks started putting out wonderful examples, and then they caught themselves and said, but this won't work. Why won't it work? They have too much homework. I mean, literally, was the answer. Well, they've got too much homework. We've got finding how we can help the community not automatically defer to a century-old definition of what school is that says, these are all the skills I want my young people to learn. I think they can learn them there and there and there. I'd love it if we could expand those programs. That would be great. I'd love to send my kids there. I'm doing that now, but you know what? When they come home, they still have 2 hours of homework to do. And I'm concerned that if I get them more, even if you open more of these, I'm concerned if I try to get them more invested in the kinds of opportunities they're going to build these skills, they're going to be penalized. They're going to be penalized because they're not doing their homework. So how do we get educators into conversation, not to be beaten up? Mm. You know, the other thing, the other way that we sort of start this conversation, we help communities use the Gallup poll, the free Gallup poll, which you know about well, hope, engagement, well-being. Nobody has a corner on that market. Everybody believes that they should be able to have some way to help young people be more hopeful, more engaged, thriving. The engagement data is the data that just people look at and go, why is that? And this is a survey for 5th to 12th graders, and it doesn't matter which community you do it in. For every year that they're in school, it's a stair step. They're less engaged. It drops. We assume the kids come to kindergarten 100% engaged. By 5th grade, when they're measured, two-thirds of them are engaged, one-third have already started to check out. And then it just drops, you know, 5 percentage points. Then we get to high school, only a third of them are saying that they're engaged. But they're interested in the conversation.
I don't know what's wrong with that third. Why are they still
there? Why are they still there?
I think I vaguely remember being a teenager. There is a little arc to the way we feel in life.
But there are lots of folks who say we know what to do there. When we get the kids, they are engaged, and that goes back to that core definition of what that quality environment is, which is that combination of content you care about being applied towards something that has meaning and giving you opportunity to actually not only master the content but practice these skills. So, you know, how do we change that conversation?
There's a big tension, and Sean alluded to it, in our own lives, in our private lives, our families or our extended families, the world is pretty kid-centric, actually. Right, it's all about what does that child need? That child needs these things, and this other child, same parents, needs these other things. But when we get to the world of education and programs, it becomes system centric, program centric. The kid's not at the center anymore. The kid is a receiver of services, and nobody's sitting around. And for kids who don't have highly engaged parents or parents who really can help those kids imagine a brighter future and work towards that brighter future and manage that process for them, kids are just having a series of experiences. Of course, better if they're higher quality, but I still think we have to go a little deeper. Like, if we put each young person at the center of what we're trying to accomplish, we view the world differently, right? It's just our government's funding system doesn't work that way. Our program system, we have programs competing to serve kids. I'm competing for money to serve kids and see no real value in talking to the other guys, because what they have to prove is they're so awesome on their own that they get all the money. So big tensions in how our world works and what we'd actually like to see for kids, I think.
You could be a whole child spokesperson. That little spiel. putting the child back at the center. And it does change what you're trying to do and how you're trying to do it. You know, but the problem is, and this is what we're discussing here, the problem is that we've got a system which has been built up where the child is at the periphery, or the child is one of the pieces in this machine, as opposed to being in the center of this structure. And so the question is, how do we start to change this system and put the child back in the center, and also get the accountability system and the metrics that keep the child in the center? Because currently we start to get these metrics which take on a life of their own, you know, and we lose track of where we're trying to get to.
So what's the most out there, far-fetched, but feasible strategy that you can think of to get this moving?
I'm a strong believer in you need to change mindsets before you then start to change some of the systems. Now, I agree that you start to tinker with the systems and that in itself might change mindsets, but I think I'm a strong believer that we need to go back to the conversation about what are we trying to get kids ready for, therefore what's the purpose of an education system, and what are the skills. And I think the more people that we can bring into that conversation, not just educators, not just policy makers, but community service agencies, communities at large, the more we can have that conversation about what are we trying to do here and what's our focus, it'll start to change the subsequent conversation, because at least we're all heading towards the same ultimate goal.
Okay, I have two ideas, one at the highest level and one at the most close to the ground, granular level.
All right, we'll take them both, and then we'll head to questions.
Okay, at the highest level, I think what you said, Sean, is exactly right. We actually need a national reframing of what it means to be ready. Karen, obviously, you ought to lead that effort. You got the right name for your organization. I'm not sure if 21 is right, but the ready is right.
Ready is right. We tried 25. 25-year-old's objective. But
yeah, I bet. Don't you get into my life. I really think that a definition of readiness, and I think there's a ripeness to this. People are frustrated with the narrow definition, and frustrated also that we're failing with the narrow definition. We've created a narrow definition, and then not enough people are graduating, and those who are graduating aren't ready enough. This is not working, right?
Okay.
And it's misaligned. At the most granular level, I love programs. I think programs are really important. I think the most important attribute to add to kids' lives, now I'm thinking mostly about low-income kids who are not growing up in circumstances in which they're surrounded by high-performing individuals. We need more people in these kids' lives.
Absolutely.
People. Kids need more opportunities to interact with people who've been successful in one way or another and who will take some responsibility, partial responsibility, for showing that young person what success looks like and for helping that young person navigate and negotiate their way toward that success.
Good. All right.
I'll agree with that, and I'll one little example that we did in schools where we called them almost the unknown students, where you'd go into school sometimes, and they'd be smaller schools, so maybe they're an elementary school, a couple of hundred, and you put every child's name on a whiteboard, and then ask all the staff to go up there and say, which of these kids do you know? And this is the staff and maybe the employees as well. There is always 10% of the kids who have almost no adults that know them.
Right.
And they're not the kids who are the sports people or the award winners or the high achievers. They're also not the ones who
they're not the knuckleheads, right. They're also not the knuckleheads.
They're the ones who are quiet. They're the ones who get the job done but don't make a fuss and don't make a noise. But they are the ones that don't have anyone connected to them.
Good.
And so what we end up doing is saying, all right, John, here are five kids that I want you to get to know this term. Karen, here are five more you need to get to know.
And that works amazingly well.
Have a connection.
It works amazingly well, and what we know is it works well, and it helps schools on accountability with some of the things that helps with the behavior side.
Mm.
Whether the achievement goes up right away, the attendance tends to go up, and the behavior problems go down.
Yeah.
But I'm going to stop us, which I know is hard to do, and introduce Ian Fagley, who's going to give us some questions, as folks have been sending in questions, and we'll take the remaining time to see if we can get brief answers to what I'm sure
we'll are. We'll go for short answers now. Okay, we apologize for gassing on.
Tweet them out.
And we're overwhelmed by the amount of activity and questions coming through the Twitter feed. If we don't get to your question, we will be blogging and answering questions after the fact. So we'll
excellent.
We've got a huge stack of questions. I'll start with one that a few people asked. Can any of you point to a place where you think they're doing it right? They've got this figured out. They've decided on what these competencies are and are implementing a plan to say who can help kids build which competencies, and a place where schools and OST providers are working together well to build those competencies?
We, each year for the last 5 years, have given out a whole child award to the school that's doing the most amazing things around our whole child approach, ensuring that each kid is healthy, safe, engaged, supported, challenged. So on our website, we have some great examples of schools, and they also tend to have something common about them as well. It's not just a focus on these attributes. It's also a focus, as we were saying, on caring for the kids, knowing who the kids are, and also having really strong links back into their local community. And so it's some of those other things that really make those schools work. The last one we awarded was Washington Montessori in North Carolina. Before that, Milwaukee High School in Oregon. But there's some great examples out there, and I'm sure John has.
I think that's really the secret of what's happening in high-performing charter schools. I'm for charter schools. I'm for regular public schools too. But I think, and we know there's a great range of charter schools. But I think in the highest-performing charter schools, they're sort of taking this end-to-end approach with young people from 7 o'clock in the morning till 6 in the evening that includes and integrates all the sort of traditional academic learning with all the caring adults, with all the activities. And my guess is that's the secret to their success. Yeah.
Good. I think there are lots of examples. The forum has been writing up some profiles, which we'll be posting after this as well. And the one that I'll add, just in terms of a model to show how schools can change to do this, I think that works very well is New Tech High Schools, which have focused in on sort of low-income disadvantaged kids, brought in project-based learning, but done it in a way that's been very explicit that we can actually name, we can deal with the Common Core standards, but we can also name the skills that we're going to make sure kids leave with. Communication skills, problem-solving skills, teamwork skills, self-regulation skills, and their report card. So we're not going to fancy measures, and I know one of the questions I'm sure that's come in is how do you measure this stuff? We could kill ourselves trying to figure out how you measure it, but the old-fashioned way of actually naming it and having teachers and students report on it regularly. So in New Tech High Schools, half of your grade comes from the teacher and your peers saying how well you did on those skills, and half comes from the demonstration that you've mastered the content. So two kids could get a C-minus, one mastered the content, but wasn't a part of the team,
turned their stuff in late, didn't have a good work ethic. The other one really worked hard on those skills but struggled with the content. When that report card goes home to the parent and when that report card's handed to that student who's in high school, they get so much more information, like you were saying, John, than if they just get a grade.
Yeah. By the way, I think good employers, that's what reviews look like from good employers. Half of it is, are you doing your work really well? The other half of it is, are you helping others through their work? Are you exhibiting these skills that are crucial to our workplace functioning well?
So, Ian, we're clearly showing we can't give you short answers.
But you answered the next set of questions already in talking about some people did ask kind of what are some of the measures that are currently used, what are the instruments to measure resiliency and perseverance. As a related question, there's a lot of terms, grit, perseverance, integrity, communications, SEL, et cetera. How much real difference is there between these terms, and how do you come to a common community definition?
Good, hard questions. On the first one of measurement, yes, we just mentioned sort of using the old-fashioned way of sort of getting consensus around are you doing it well with a common definition developed by your school and your peers. That is working well in new tech highs, but it's also working well in youth organizations that are naming these things explicitly. The second thing I think is not good news, there are literally hundreds, I forget who just put out the review, hundreds of different questions and indicators on surveys that are pointing to these different things. Very few of them actually work practically. They work well on researchers' surveys. They don't work well for observation and practice and growth. So we've got some folks, as a part of the forums team, the Weichert Center is working on some of those skills to be measured. But what that requires is you boil down the names. So that second question, if there's 100 different words, do we really have 100 different skills? The answer is no. And in some ways, kind of like the five promises for America's Promise, we just need communities to come in and almost do their own natural cluster analysis and see what works for them. We're trying to do some of this here at the forum. We've got Stephanie Krause sort of cranking through everybody's lists and seeing what that looks like, and we'll try to be putting some of that out shortly.
But I think it's also what John was saying before, what they all have in common, whether it's CASEL or National School Climate Institute or Character Ed, it's about putting the child back at the center and seeing that they're more than just the academic or the cognitive. And the different ways that you phrase it and the different ways that you pass it out, it is a more holistic view of the child.
Absolutely. And as long as we have a cluster of those that really represent different dimensions of what people consistently say we need to have, we're a ways away from having absolute consensus on the definitions, but I think we can very quickly help communities put something in this space where right now there's a void.
Well, I think it's really important to do this, Karen, and in the way that you just talked about this, because I love Angela Duckworth and Bill Damon and those guys and Dave Levin who are doing the work on character, but I actually think it's too narrow. And while the word character is very powerful, it's also a little electric. It's a little bit of a third rail. And it doesn't capture the seven attributes Angela is looking for. It doesn't capture everything that Sean was talking about or you talking about. But they're winning the race right now. And we need to get in that race and say yes and these other things.
Yeah. Well, Ian has four more questions here on the table in front of me and many more flowing in. So we're going to make an absolute commitment to both post the questions, and I've got John and Sean both agreeing that we will sort of take turns answering so we can keep this conversation going online for a while longer. But we've gotten to the magic hour, and I want to thank both John and Sean, as well as Ian and Amy, for keeping the Twitter lines open. This has been great, and we will do it again, absolutely.
Love to.
Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen.